pause after each question. Are there any further comments or remarks? Don't hesitate to make it. The first question, after your criticisms of writings in the New World last week, how should we receive the pitch yesterday at Mass to subscribe to it? Well, I could say that you receive the pitch, but in such a way as to make it clear to those who edit the New World that what you want there is the fullness of Catholic teaching. Frankly, I don't think you people realize as much as you might what great power you have in your hands. Nothing will be published, nothing will be done unless there is somebody who is willing to support and subscribe to it. You will get what you believe to be the fullness of Catholic teaching if you insist, and make sure I understand that in the is of the current issue, there were several very pertinent letters written to the editor, am I correct? Which I would strongly recommend continuing. How do we single out the authority of the Church? Well, in the Catholic Church, there should be no great problem. In the practical order, those who agree with the Holy See are in agreement with the authority in the Catholic Church. Those who contradict or disagree with the authority of the Holy See should be suspect as perhaps being misunderstood or misunderstanding what they're saying. If you didn't misunderstand them, they are wrong. Is the overpopulation and resultant starvation of people in India evidence of God's love or man's ignorance? Well, I'm not quite sure what the questioner means by asking whether the overpopulation and starvation is evidence of God's love. I would say it is evidence of God's love to the extent to which those who see that suffering and starvation do something about it, which is the main reason why they're suffering on earth. Besides, of course, somehow expiating sin, one of the main reasons for suffering on earth is to evoke compassion, sympathy, and love from those who can help those in need. Is it a sign of man's ignorance? Well, partly. Although we must add this too, and this is a much larger issue than I could possibly cover in answering one question, I would commend you reading the chapter on Christian marriage in the book Christianity in the 20th Century. In the last analysis, it depends on where we place our treasure, as Christ told us. No one is happy with people suffering hunger. But let's be honest. We were not made for this world. And consequently, in the long stretch of eternity, God has reasons for permitting hunger, poverty, and starvation, which, from his viewpoint, make sense that from ours may not. The least that it does is to give us a chance to practice our faith and trust in God. Has the Pope ever spoken ex cathedra on birth control? Well, it all depends on what a person means or what a questioner means by ex cathedra. Ex cathedra can mean two things. It can mean a formality, or it can mean infallibility, that is, indefectible doctrine. As a formality, no. Neither the present Pope nor previous popes have, as for example we had for defining Mary's Immaculate Conception or her Assumption, there has not been that kind of an ex cathedra formal pronouncement, which when there is certainly infallible. However, the teaching not only of this Pope, but of previous pontiffs is ex cathedra in the sense that it is an expression of the constant teaching of the Catholic Church on the most sacred responsibility of marriage. And as I've told people, if the Catholic Church, a contrary to fact hypothesis, were to change its teaching on contraception and say that it is now permissible, for over all these centuries it is said it is wrong, it would not merely cease to be the Catholic Church, there would not be a church founded by Christ. Because the Catholic faithful would have been, from the beginnings of Christian history, been taught erroneously. Many people are using the word adultery as a loophole for extra curricular sex, assuming that it is adultery only if one of the partners are married. Can you point out where the Bible explicitly forbids all sex outside of marriage? Well, clearly, and I'm sure the questioner knows, that technically adultery means sexual relations where one or the other person is married, and clearly they are not husband and wife. So either both are married or one is married, then it is adultery. However, in answer to the question where the Bible explicitly forbids all sex outside of marriage, I would say the most detailed, not merely statement, but even description of sexual aberration outside of marriage is in St. Paul, especially in his letter to the Romans and his letters to the Corinthians, where he says, those who do such things, like fornication, which would touch the question under discussion, will not inherit the kingdom of heaven. St. Paul is the clearest and most explicit biblical authority for the prohibition of all deliberate sex indulgence outside of marriage. And do you know why? Because the Romans, among whom the Christians lived, and the Corinthians, among whom the Christians lived, had all kinds of sex experience outside of marriage. In teaching, as I do, an occasional course on comparative morality, in comparing Christian moral standards with those of the non-Christian world, I point out, and I think this is relevant here, that from the very beginning of its existence, Christianity was born, as we obviously know, in a pagan society. What was pagan about that pagan society? Well, they had their multiple gods. They had Zeus and Jupiter in the pantheon. They had all kinds of, well, strange things by our standards. Well, when you read that, it's more bizarre, we would think, than unchristian. What, in one simple sentence, is most unchristian about a pagan society like the type in which Christianity came into existence? You know what? Sexual morality. The Mediterranean world into which Christianity was born was a world that practiced widespread contraception, widespread abortion, fornication, adultery. In one of the letters of Cicero, you know, he is a famous Roman philosopher and a statesman, he speaks of a Roman senator being late for the Senate meeting one day. Now, maybe the manuscript of Cicero's writings made a mistake, but at least the text says, the senator said to his fellow senators, "Sorry, gentlemen, for being late. I have just divorced my 24th wife." Consequently, the sign, and I mark my definite article, the sign of a Christian in the first three centuries of the Christian era was his sexual behavior. He or she didn't fornicate, did not abort, did not commit adultery, was faithful to his or her spouse, and brought offspring into the world. In fact, if the Christians hadn't done it, well, they wouldn't have needed the Roman persecutions to put them out of existence. We wouldn't be around to talk about it. And what's happening in America today is, that's why I say on the jacket, the editor decided to put it there, on the book, I consider the last 70 years, that is the first 70 of this century, in their way, as crucial for Christianity as the first 70 of the first century. We are now reliving a post-Christian era in which more and more of our contemporaries are, well, they're not Romans or Greeks, Mesopotamians or Phoenicians. They are Americans. But they are, by the standards of Christ and Saint Paul, pagans. and the persecution that our forebears suffered in the first 300 years, we are suffering now, and I mark my words, and there is more coming. Only God knows how many of us will survive. I mean, as Christians. All I know is that after the period of winnowing, when the storm will cease, those who will be left will be Christians. And nobody else. We're scared, I am, of the price we've got to pay for being a Christian in this century. So were the people under Nero and Diocletian. You said that marriage between two baptized people cannot be dissolved except by death. Is this true also of a marriage between a Catholic and a person of another religion? Well, it all depends. If that other person is a Christian, which means baptized, and neither Catholic nor his partner had been married before, in other words, it's a valid marriage, and they have intercourse after their wedding, yes, that marriage is indissoluble, even though it is, in fact, they don't have to be two Catholics. Neither need be a Catholic. Two Presbyterians, two Methodists. No surprise. You knew that, didn't you? A marriage between two Methodists, presumably baptized, is indissoluble except by death. Is the large amount of divorces you mentioned only referring to Catholic marriages? Oh no, thank God, Catholic divorces are not yet that bad. So this is what's the national figure. Is it permissible for a Catholic who is marrying a non-Catholic person to get married in both religions? No. Though, as you know, and we explained it, I think, the last time, that it is permissible now for a Catholic marrying, for example, a Protestant to be married validly before a Protestant minister in a Protestant church with appropriate dispensation from the Catholic Church. But there's only one marriage. Now, there are people who do indeed go through two ceremonies. One person that I knew did that. Her mother was very upset over her becoming Catholic, pleaded with her not to break her mother's heart by being married in the Catholic Church. So, that was by long-distance telephone call. She promised her mother she wouldn't. So what did she do? Early in the morning, before sunrise, behind locked doors, just enough witnesses in the church to make the marriage valid, it was performed in a Catholic church before a Catholic priest. Her husband was Catholic, too. In the meantime, she had entered the church. Then in the evening, not telling your mother anything, she shouldn't have done it. I'm just telling you what she did. There was a big Baptist home wedding and the mother was satisfied. All I can tell you is the second was not a marriage. I feel that the rejection of absolutes and the craze for situation ethics that fills our religion courses today are a result of the atrocities committed by Nazi Germany and the testimonies at Nuremberg. I see little difference between the Nazi commandant who, though blind obedience to a superior, allowed bodies to be destroyed because he had not written the law, and the Catholic pastor who, through blind obedience to his superior, allowed souls to be destroyed because he did not write the religion books. How can we lay people who have removed our children from Catholic schools make our pastors realize that obeying a Catholic conscience is as necessary for his salvation as it is for ours? I don't think I need to much respond to what is not really a question as an observation. I am afraid that most of what this statement reads is true. And not only regarding pastors, but regarding bishops. As on occasion they allow me to tell them. Assuming these four pillars were provided almost 100%, and you see your growing daughters and sons growing into manhood and womanhood, and have the signs of succumbing to situational ethics and defending them by their company and attitude, what do you do to continue to remind them and thus start arguments to the possible actions of them leaving home, or just remain silent and pray, or occasionally dare to speak up? Only God knows the answer to this question. I would say, however, and as you might have gathered from the last lecture that I gave, it was quite different from the others. One reason was that I didn't feel that for this fourth lecture I should burden you with any more, though I didn't think I gave you too much theological theory. Marriage and the family is separating father from son, mother from daughter, wife from husband. All I can say on a practical level is, in season and out of season, remind yourself, and we've got to convince ourselves first. You know, we're the hardest people to convince. Be absolutely convinced that what I conveniently, I could have used other labels, what I conveniently called four pillars, have been given to us by the Son of God. What do I mean? That without these four pillars, there is no Christian family. But we've got to be dead sure that's true. Meetings like this help. Meeting with people who can strengthen your faith and you theirs. I don't think I never realized how important it was until recently to be able to unburden your soul with somebody who understands what you're saying, and he or she to you. You know what I'm talking about? Don't trust intellectuals. The faith of the people in large measure is among those who may be intelligent. Indeed, there's no connection, by the way, between an intelligent person and an intellectual. Not to be taken in by so much jargon, theological nonsense, and learned books that I wish they just said nothing that too many of our priests, religious, and teachers in Catholic institutions, having read and inspired, are now passing on that folly to others. Work together, know one another, cooperate, coordinate, organize, stick together, stand together, speaking for enough priests and members of the hierarchy. They want your support. Given these 4 Mondays, I've given anything to you, believe me, you've taught me a lot. What do you believe the sex education programs will eventually and probably become and will probably do to our children? Well, clearly, some kind or some amount of sex education is indispensable and has always been given. Any well-rounded education from years back included some education in preparing for marriage and how to live with one's sex faculties. But I believe that a great deal of what now masks as sex education is actually sex perversion. And there again, to be on the alert, to fight for your rights, and above all, protect your children from a state that I am afraid is trying to get control of your offspring. Being a member of a high school religion course run by Jesuits, the question arose in the course that even though the Pope denied the use of abortion, would it be a sin for a woman to have an abortion if she felt it was okay under the circumstances? For one of the qualifications for sin is to deliberately offend God, even though you know it is wrong. Well, let's unravel that question. Let's look at this woman who feels it is okay to have an abortion under the circumstances. What's the question? The question is, would it be a sin for this woman if she aborted? Well, it all depends. All depends on what? All depends on what she understands by it's okay. If she is sufficiently aware of her religious responsibilities, and she'd have to be a very strange woman, and I mean just a woman, not to know this. And she felt it was okay, well, provided, and that's the only condition necessary, provided she knew enough about the moral law to sense that she was somehow tampering with human life, she would sin. Now, it is possible, tragically, having counsel, for example, unwed mothers, it is possible, for example, for a girl to be so confused and mixed up that in the act of aborting, often under pressure from the man, and sometimes, incredibly, from her mother, who wants to protect not the girl, but her own reputation, the girl aborts. Well, it may be, though her mind tells her it is wrong, and that's all that's necessary for her to sin, if her emotions so color her mind as to really make it impossible for her to think straight. The degree of her guilt is known to God alone, and only He can judge. Please comment on the Committee of Catholic Laymen Pro Ecclesia publications like Triumph and the Wanderer and the book called Survival of Dogma. Are any of these too conservative? Are any groups in the church today too conservative? You said you would mention some good Catholic writers this week. Thank you. First, regarding these books and magazines, I'm not familiar with all of them, but what I know about them allows me to say that while they do often express themselves very strongly on doctrinal issues, they are called either too conservative or simply conservative only by those who have less than full regard for the fullness of Catholic teaching. I think I mentioned last week, I consider the adjectives conservative and traditionalist insulting. The issues in the church today are not adjectival, they are substantive. It's not a question of degree, conservative or liberal. It's a question of principle. I said that I would mention some good Catholic writers this week. Had I been able to do more homework, I would have mentioned more persons. I think myself that one way to judge the validity of an author is the publishing house, at least now, that publishes his material. Now, Doubleday, that published my last book, happens to be a secular publisher, so I would say that doesn't count. But have you heard of the Scepter Publishing House? Its headquarters, I believe, are in Ireland. It has a publishing branch in Chicago. And it regularly publishes statements of the Holy Father. It periodically publishes pamphlets and brochures, and occasionally puts out books. The Alba Press tries, I know the editors, to publish books that are within the ambit of authentic Catholic Christianity. On the spiritual level, and I would say especially for spiritual reading and for religious women, though also for anyone, the St. Paul Publishing House in Boston, in fact, they publicly thanked me for doing this. Shortly after the documents of Vatican II were published, that is the English edition, the Abbott edition, I read the Latin text. And I said to myself, something is wrong. The kindest term I can use for the Abbott translation of the Second Vatican Council is, it is consciously inaccurate. Only God knows the damage that translation has done. The only English translation of the Second Vatican Council that I ever use or recommend is of the St. Paul editions in Boston. And among Jesuit writers, you would want me to recommend some Jesuit. Two men who have meant so much in my own life are two French Jesuits, Danielu and de Lubac. I wish I could recommend Karl Rahner unreservedly. I admire his genius. I have less than full respect for the integrity of his faith. Yes. Oh, de Lubac. D-E-L-U-A-D-E-L-U-B-A-C, de Lubac. D-E-L-U-B-A-C, de Lubac. Henry. Yes. Please. I didn't get the first part of your question. Is he a friend of Teilhard? Well, yes, he was a very close friend of Teilhard. He wrote what I consider the most balanced book on Teilhard de Chardin. Chardin has to be very carefully qualified, as I try to do in my own book. There's the believing side of Teilhard de Chardin, and there is the unbelieving side. And you better know which side you're reading when you read him. De Lubac's book on Chardin, I think, does a very creditable job on the man's memory. Today a priest told us that a Catholic bishop is encouraging young people under 21 to have a civil marriage first, rather than enter into a Catholic union that may not work out. According to what you said, this cannot be. Well, no, it cannot be by the teachings of Christ, but it may well be by the teachings of a man who may still call himself, sadly, a Catholic bishop. How can a good Catholic in conscience be a patriotic American with America so unchristian? Well, it all depends on what America we love. We cannot love that part of America, that phase of America, which is undercutting our deepest convictions. Only the Lord knows how many strong believing Christians in America are still left. I'd like to think, I hope I'm right, the majority. Though I would have to say that, remember, by those same Christian standards, and you're going to be surprised, I think, when I say this, by those same Christian standards, our faith requires that we love a country even though it is not Christian. Whatever authority there is from God. The Christians who were martyred by the Roman emperors were to be patriotic. You hear that? Patriotic, even to the empire which persecuted them, while doing everything in their Christian power, and they succeeded in Christianizing their society. You know how they did it? With their blood. There is no theological, doctrinal, or biblical argument for obligatory celibacy. Would you agree? Well, I don't think I have to agree, because there is no obligatory celibacy. nobody is obliged, period, to be celibate. So I have nothing to agree with. If the question had been, is there any argument for mandatory celibacy for priests in the Latin Rite, I'd say yes, on two grounds. The strongest argument is, by now I know it's strong because I've used it with so many of my Protestant clerical friends. I know so many, I deal with them professionally. Celibacy regularly comes up in conversation. How come, they ask, the Catholic Church has a hang-up on celibacy? I tell them, you, a student of the Bible, dare say that? Was Jesus Christ married or a celibate? Well, they admit he was celibate. I ask them why. I don't know. Why, I tell them, neither do I. But if a priest is to be another Christ, the symbolism, the sign value, the example of being truly another Christ to his people by the sacrifice that celibacy requires, if it is kept faithfully, has been first shown by Christ, and over the centuries of the Church's history, I remind them, do you know that in the early Church, celibacy was not mandatory because so many wanted to be celibate like Christ? And as a consequence, in time, will be allowed a marriage clergy, and they still have it. The Church needs a celibate priesthood, and that, I don't hesitate saying, is part of Christ's revelation that there will be celibate priests, that they are all celibate, that the Church has never said they must be, and presumably never will. Now, how authoritative are the documents of the Second Vatican Council? If they are not infallible, can the average Catholic take them or leave them, depending on his personal whims? Well, I would say that while, obviously, both Pope John and Pope Paul VI said that the Vatican Council was not meant to define any new doctrine, yet a great deal of the teaching in the Second Vatican Council is simply the historic, undivided, and therefore infallible teaching of the Church over the centuries. Moreover, many controversial issues were settled. And frankly, the problem for a believing Catholic is not how little must I believe, but how much, with God's grace, can I believe? Those who raise questions about the infallibility of the Vatican Council, I think, have problems deeper than the technical character of the definitive teaching of a council of the Church. Please discuss Sunday Mass. What really is our obligation? Who said so? How did the Italians get away without observing it? isn't it only a church rule and not morally binding? Well, what really is our obligation? The foundation for the Sunday Mass goes back to the first century, indeed goes back to the scriptures. We know first century evidence and all subsequent centuries that Christians went to Mass at least every Sunday. I might add, by the way, just for your information, communion was Holy Communion was part of the Sunday obligation . Who says so? Christ says so. How do the Italians get away without observing it? Well, I'm not quite sure how to answer that, except that having been in Italy, of course, there are non-observant Italians. All I can say is there are a lot of non-observant Americans. Isn't it only a church rule and not morally binding? No, it's not only a church rule, and it is morally binding. Now, the fact that the Catholic Church has specified as a church law, it has Sunday obligation, and then spelled out certain days of obligation, as we call them, for example. What's today? Monday. Next Wednesday, right? A day of obligation. That is indeed a church law. But if you ask me what the foundation for the church law is, it is the divine law. On two counts. First, that God must be regularly worship, he wants to be. That's the divine law. And the best form of worship to God that a Catholic can give is to assist at Mass. No higher worship can be given. I get nothing out of it. Doesn't mean a thing. God wants to be adored. The highest act of adoration I can give God is by assistance at Mass. God has a right to it. Secondly, we need the grace. God knows we need it. The most powerful source of grace we have as Catholics is fervent assistance at the Holy Sacrifice, especially if we join it with Holy Communion. The basic differences between Roman Catholicism and every other form of Christianity is its understanding of ecclesiastical office, and notes specifically the office of the Pope. Do you agree? I don't like the word office. However, the difference basically, no. The Pope is certainly very basic to the difference. When I talk to priests, I tell them, what's the basic difference between Catholicism and Protestantism? Well, they usually say the papacy. I tell them, no, the basic difference is the priesthood. Catholicism has the priesthood. Protestantism does not. Now, in Orthodoxy, which has the priesthood, the difference is the papacy. The place of family stability in European and Latin societies has been the acceptance of a double moral standard, the triumvirate of husband, wife, and mistress. So, you see any chance of the chaotic condition of marriage in the United States leading to a firmer base? Do you see any chance of the chaotic condition of marriage in the United States leading to a firmer base for marriage? I wish I could speak more firmly than I can, because I'm a North American. But I know Latin Americans, and I know Europeans. And all I can say is, as a blanket statement, that for European and Latin societies, the triumvirate of husband, wife, and mistress is calumny. Would you please repeat your definition of conscience? Conscience is the human mind, enlightened by whatever faith the person has, which tells the person what he should do in any given moral situation, whether it is morally good or morally bad. And as such, it is a judgmental faculty. It is not, as some are now using it, a law-making faculty. God makes the laws, not the human mind. Father, what is your opinion of Father Imbiorski's Becoming a Person program? Just to enlighten myself, is this the program that is published by, is it Benzinger? I believe it is subversive of authentic Christian morality. What is the scriptural basis for the condemnation of birth control? I'm watching the time. Let me say this. First of all, may I commend my own book, and I keep referring to it, not because I'm evading a subject, but because it's such a vast one. Read the chapter on marriage, which spells out in great detail the biblical basis for the church's position on contraception. I would say the biblical basis for the church's teaching on birth control is Christ's commandment of love. He tells us to love as he loved us, which means selflessly. This commandment to love is obviously to be observed by different people in different ways. For a married couple, they don't have to have intercourse to show their mutual affection, though that certainly shows their mutual love. But when they have marital intercourse, as Christians who are married, they must exercise that intercourse as an expression of not only their love between themselves, but of their joint love for the yet unborn and unconceived child whom God may give them. To one who doesn't have the Christian faith, that's nonsense. For one who believes, we know we can love those who don't yet exist, even as God, who became man, loved us before we existed. He better have, otherwise we would still be the vacuum that we used to be. It's a mystery, the mystery of love. Only faith understands it. Everybody else, it's meaningless. I would like to hear your opinion of the problem of overpopulation. Does it exist? If so, what is the answer? Well, in lecturing on the subject of the problem of overpopulation, I distinguish between problem and overpopulation. I admit there is a problem. I deny there is cosmic overpopulation. The problem is in great measure partly created not by too many births, but by too few deaths. Do you know that in the United States our lifespan has been increased by, well, it's close to 30 years per man, woman, and child since the turn of the century. You multiply 200 million times 30. You have an astronomical figure. People are living longer. The second reason for the problem is the injustice, the greed, and the avarice of man towards man. If so, what is the answer? Well, the answer is mainly, I would say, a re-examination, the reassessment of where the problem is heaviest, for example, in Asia and Africa. Take, for example, the huge continent of Australia. Some time ago, and with this I think I should close this question, it's too big. Some time ago, the Catholic bishops of Australia warned their people to practice that Christian justice and charity which their fabulous natural resources allows them to open up their continent to millions of others. Australia is within a short jet flight of mainland China. It is empty. China has over 700 million people. I think the solution is mainly in the heart of man. Thank you for your lectures and the opportunity to reaffirm our faith. When and where will you lecture next? My next lectures will be in Cleveland, Ohio, next weekend. I'm lecturing on Friday and Sunday. You have told of the teachings within the contemporary Catholic Church which you believe are against Christ's value system. Now you must tell us of some modern Catholic teachings since Vatican II, which you believe are a step forward in carrying out Christ's gospel teachings. The only one definite thing which I have heard you mention was the improved relations with non-Catholic churches. There must be more. Give us more hope. I will say a prayer for this questioner. Please explain what grace is and what you mean when you say it will help us today. Grace is what only God can give us, over and above what we already have, whether we're born with or born into. Grace is that which God normally gives in answer to our prayers. How come the Church is drastically changing its rules and positions on certain topics that would damn a person forever? For example, if a person ate meat on Friday 10 years ago and died with that sin, why is it all right? Could the same go for all attending Mass in 10 years? No. The two commandments are in a different category. However, even regarding the Friday abstinence, I might add, by the way, there is still the law of penance, and what is not commonly known, the law of penance, especially on Friday. The point is that the Church, being divinely instituted by Christ to communicate His will, has a right to tell us what God wants us to do, and consequently, the Church may tell us, under one circumstance or in one period, this will be an act of penance. Frankly, I think for most Americans, Friday abstinence was no longer penitential. The reason for the change in Friday abstinence was not to remove penance, but rather to make it more stringent. What kind of an answer can I give to a co-worker who says, if I had children, I would train them to love God and their fellow men outside the church? Why burden them with rules instituted by a human organization for its own physical well-being? Well, either the person believes that the church is not a human society and instituted by Christ, or you could not argue with such a person. You stated that the primary right of education was the parents. It would thus seem schools should be lean towards historical facts rather than attitudes, behavioral sciences, and brainwashing. What primary rights do the state or Catholic schools have in regard to sex education, sensitivity training, and in presenting a bias of socialism with capitalism? Well, I would say parents always reserve, even with Catholic schools, the right to decide whether those schools are usurping what they, the parents, have a primary right from God to teach. Would you please comment on the social studies, Harcourt Embrace books on the table that are used in the local Catholic grade school? I didn't have much of a chance to look at them. What I did see, however, seemed to me to be very daring, because I felt that the ideas there expressed were along the lines of what I call positivistic behaviorist morality. Beyond that, I don't know any more to say more. Thank you again.